Omaha Public Radio presents another program from Film Streams, Omaha's nonprofit cinema on Noon Forum. On today's program, we'll hear a panel discussion which followed a special screening of the 2014 film A Borrowed Identity, directed by Aaron Riklis. This program, presented in collaboration with the Schwab Center for Israel and Jewish Studies at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, October 27, 2015, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the panelists and do not necessarily represent those of Film Streams, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. The members of the panel will be the screenwriter of the film, Syed Kashua, well known in Israel for his weekly column in the newspaper Haaretz, and for writing Arab Labor, a groundbreaking television sitcom that explored racial and cultural tensions. Mr. Kashua currently teaches at the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana. And Asaf Gavron, visiting Israeli professor at the University of Nebraska at Omaha's Schwab Center, and author of several books, many of which have been translated into German, Russian, Italian, French, English, Dutch, Swedish, Greek, and Hungarian. His latest novel is The Hilltop. The moderator will be Curtis Hutt, professor of Judaic Studies, and special programs coordinator for the Schwab Center at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. A Borrowed Identity, adapted for the screen from Kashua's 2012 memoir, tells the story of Iyad, a Palestinian-Israeli boy given the chance to go to a prestigious Jewish boarding school in Jerusalem. As he desperately tries to fit in with his Jewish schoolmates and within Israeli society, Iyad develops a friendship with Yonatan, another outsider, a boy with muscular dystrophy, and gradually becomes part of the home Yonatan shares with his mother. After falling in love with Naomi, a Jewish girl, he leaves school when their relationship is discovered, and he finds that he will have to sacrifice his identity in order to be accepted. Faced with a choice, Iyad will have to make a decision that will change his life forever. Here now to introduce the program is Moshe Gershovich, the director of the Schwab Center for Israel and Jewish Studies at the University of Nebraska at Omaha.
I just wanted to say a few words. First of all, I'm so overwhelmed to see how many of you have come, and so many good friends and colleagues and students, of course, in my classes and other students who are at UNO and elsewhere, in other universities. I wanted to say a few things about our special guest tonight, Syed Kashua, and about the film. I'll be very, very brief. Like many other Israelis, I've been following the writing of Syed Kashua for a number of years. I've read all his books and his weekly columns in the Israeli daily Haaretz, as well as following some of his television work, including the very successful TV series Arab Labor. And I always wanted to actually get to meet him in person. And when I heard last year that he was coming to the U.S. and actually quite close to where we are, he's now residing in Illinois, in Urbana, where he's teaching, I knew that I wanted to find an opportunity to bring here. And then Asaf came to be with us last year, and I found out from Asaf that he and Syed are very good friends, which made it even more of a determination to find an opportunity. And then came the third element, which was the films that you are about to see, the film that is based on two of Syed Kashua's books. One of them, by the way, is available for purchase later on if you're interested at the end of the evening. And then I realized this is the great opportunity to bring the film here and to bring him as well. And then it was a question of when rather than if. And I'm so happy that tonight is the night that we get the opportunity to hear both Syed Kashua and Asaf Gavron in a discussion after the film. And I think that it will be... I'm actually one of the very few people, maybe the only person who have seen it already. So I can tell you that you're really in for a treat. I just wanted to say one small thing of interest about the title of the film, because that title has changed a few times. It started as the name Dancing Arabs, which, or in Hebrew, Aravim Rokdim, which is the title of Syed Kashua's first book and the most biographical book, autobiographical book, I think. And then it was supposed to be released last summer, and as many of you, I'm sure, know, last summer was not the best time for tolerance and goodwill in Israel and Palestine. And so the screening of the film, the premiere was delayed. And while it was delayed, the title also underwent a small change, so the presence of Arabs will not be as prominent, I guess. So now it was called Dancing Arabs / Borrowed Identity, Zehut Sheula in Hebrew. And then by the and it was released in November, and then by the time it got to the U.S., they decided to drop the Borrowed Identity, sorry, the Dancing Arabs altogether and leave it as Borrowed Identity. Now, ironically, and once you see the film, I hope you'll agree with me, ironically, I think that title may represent better the actual substance of the film. And I think that what you're going to see is a very touching film about human beings dealing with a very almost impossible situation and trying to deal with it. So I hope you'll enjoy it. Thank you all for coming.
Right now, I just want to hand it over to Dr. Curtis Hutt, who is a professor of Judaic Studies at UNO, and he's also the special projects coordinator for the Schwalb Center. Dr. Hutt?
Thank you very much. I'm going to just say a couple words to begin with. I wanted to make certain that you guys all know who you have on the stage up here. It is Omaha. I know that many people that read Hebrew know the work of Syed Kashua, and they know the work of Asaf Gavron. You've just been introduced to Syed Kashua a bit. Asaf is our has been a visiting professor through the Schusterman Program, the American-Israel Cooperation Enterprise Institute, and he's been here for about a year and a half with us. I was trying to think of how to introduce them to you best. You know that Israel is a kind of small country. It's not like the United States. If we thought about the number of books that Syed Kashua and Asaf have sold, written, sold, had translated into many different languages, I would make the comparison. I was thinking, what's the best comparison here? And I thought, how about Toni Morrison and Maya Angelou? But then I said, they're not ladies, right? They're not ladies, right? And also, in addition to that, one is Arab and one is Jewish, right? I also thought Jerry Seinfeld, because you're funny.
I'm not.
Anyways, I'd really just like to begin by saying these guys are friends and they've known each other for a bit, and I just thought maybe we'll start off by asking, how did you get to know each other? Please.
Tried to sexually abuse me.
You got to speak into the mic.
I used to work for a local magazine in Jerusalem called Kol Ha'ir. And at some point I left. I was traveling abroad, and I was quite a star, you know. People liked me in the magazine, and then when I left, I was expecting that you know, they'll miss me and they'll beg for me to come back. And suddenly, I started hearing about this new star coming up, since then, I'm kind of chasing him very far behind. But actually, the first time that we worked together was I was editing a collection of short stories and by Israeli writers, and I needed, you know, a settler, I needed a high-tech entrepreneur, I needed a filmmaker, I needed all kinds of parts of Israeli society, and of course I needed an Arab. So that's how I gave him the possibility. No, actually, I was introduced to him by people in that magazine, and I loved his work, and we published this story in the collection. And later on, we wandered around publishers in Tel Aviv and tried to find a publisher, but that didn't work out. And I don't know, since then we've been in touch.
Yeah, yes.
Do you remember a different story?
Yes, it's a... Yes, that's... that was... almost 20 years ago, so... And I'm trying to forget. But I know that... that yes, it was... I think that one of the very first... short stories to be published in anthologies. So it was actually a good one. Was published by Asaf in that collection of short stories. And yes, and then Asaf realized that I have a collection of short stories, and he wanted really to help me, to show me, you know, the real life from of Tel Aviv. So he took me from Jerusalem to Tel Aviv. He wanted to introduce me to... agents, book agents. He took me to, I don't know, I don't want to mention the name, and then other publishers. Basically, we met when Asaf introduced me all the wrong people publishing my first novel, actually. Took my money and I don't know, so it's conspiracy. But yes, Asaf was like a name in Israel because of Ochel Ba'amida. It's a legendary column that he used to write about food, but I think that when I joined the same newspaper back in 96, it was when you already left, so we met out of the newspaper, not in that newspaper, and that's it. I think it's not such a big friendship, actually. It's not doesn't sound convincing. But I love him. I think
if people would like to ask questions, this is really about you and the questions that you'd like to ask Asaf and Syed, please start raising your hands, getting in line. I would like to ask them, there's one thing. They're both here in the Midwest with us now. And, you know, Jerusalem is a very different place, especially in the last few very, very difficult months. You know, I wonder what you think about Jewish and Arab identity when you come to the United States. I mean, we don't need to talk about Jerusalem, but here.
Yes. Identity? Well, yes, I've been living here, in Champaign. Here it looks like, you know, the center of the world, compared to Champaign. Have you been? It's a wonderful university, the University of Illinois. Really wonderful, great people, and I'm very happy to be there. And it's really very flat. Let's say that maybe got there to Champaign, and you know, we landed in Chicago, and then you know I was driving into cornfields all the way 2 hours and a half to Champaign. I was completely shocked. I missed the war in Gaza back then. I said, "Oh, I can live in Jerusalem. It's okay." A little bit racism. It's not such a problem. I can survive. And then the first thing with identity that happened to me here was, it was really miserable. Everything, it was so difficult at the beginning. You arrive here with my English at least, and I couldn't even order food. I was hungry, so I went to Subway, and I like, you have here to order food very fast. And the first question was 6 inches or 12. I don't know what inch mean. And then weed white. Now I order very fast. I'm one of the fastest in the. And we really hated that. And sometimes it rains in the summer, and everything was so difficult for new immigrants. I don't know. To the States. So the identity, it was when I needed to write to register my kids to the public schools in Champaign. So I went to this office. They have a wonderful office called Unit 4 School. I have 3 kids, sorry. And so you have a list. It was the first time that I needed really to face identity here. It says race. So I was looking for Arabs in the list of race, but there are no Arabs. They have Asians, black, something like that. Yes, Hispanic, but no Arabs. And then I looked for Jews. I thought, you know, I'm carrying Israeli passport, so I can fake that. And there isn't a race for Jews also. So I raised my hand, and the lady asked, "Yes, sir, how can I help you?" And they told her, "I don't know my race. I have a problem with my race." So my kids were there, and she asked, "Where are you from, sir?" And I said, "Jerusalem." And when we came to the States, I told my kids two things, like two rules you have to know here in the States. People here stand in line, unlike Israel. There is something called line. And if you are asked, "Where are you from?" You have to say Jerusalem, because we are not yet... We don't know what people think about Palestinians and Israelis. You say Jerusalem, and then according to their reaction, you'll choose identity. So I was in the office. I raised my hand. "Yes, sir, where are you from?" "Jerusalem." "Oh, the Middle East." I said, yes. I said, "Oh, you are white, sir." So I was so happy. I looked at my kids differently. I started to love them. Three white kids. So if I was trying to do my best back in Jerusalem, you know, to survive or to assimilate to Ashkenazi Jewish writers, now I'm trying to be a white American. So I have a photo of Trump in my car now and things like that.
Let's have a comment before we open to questions.
Yeah, I mean, can't really beat that. But on a serious note, I've been following Syed and his writing for years, and this place that you saw very well in the movie of being in between the two cultures and the two identities. I've been, you know, just... really moved all the time and touched by this struggle of his. And he has a wonderful way, like just now, of you know, finding the funny parts of it. But, you know, talking when we talk on the phone, when we meet, you see that it's a real struggle of someone who really who is really trying to find the identity, and for example, this question of going back home. For me, it's not easy. It's not an easy place, and I'm not happy about many parts of it. But I know it's home, and I know that I can come back, and that will be my home, and it's just heartbreaking that. I can see that Syed is not in this position because of the place, the very specific place that he is in. So that's my not funny reaction to Syed's funny story.
Yes, it's the reality is that I don't know. I'm so tired. It's sad because when I think about my future and moving, I think about Jerusalem. It's true that the original idea was to be here for just one sabbatical year, and then I was offered by the University of Illinois to stay for three more years, and I accepted that and I think that we were very happy to have this opportunity to be far away. But it's happy, and I have to. It's really very sad. I think that during the years I tried to, at one point I realized that I think that being a Palestinian and belonging to the Palestinian minority in Israel, I think that I earned in a very decent way the fact that I can be confused when it comes to national identity. So I was accused sometimes because of the use of the Hebrew by Arab colleagues for neglecting the Arabic language and trying to assimilate and to use the Hebrew language. And I was accused, of course, by Israelis for criticizing the government and the policy and Zionism in Israel. And I think that it was a huge struggle, but I think that at one point I said, yes, that's me. I think that I really earned the fact that I can be confused and to use Hebrew, and they also earned in a very decent way the ability to criticize the Israeli society and policy and more government policy, and they thought it can work, that it's still possible to create some kind of, you know, third space that it's different, that doesn't accept segregation between Jews and Arabs. And so I think we moved 6 years before we moved to the States, to our neighborhood in Western Jerusalem. I used my kids, of course, their Hebrew is much better than mine because we used to send them to the bilingual school. Our idea about the identity was to respect, you know, the history of the Jewish partners in that school, but the best thing or the wonderful thing about that school is also they respect the suffering of the others. So they have the Israeli Memorial Day and the Independence Day, but they have also the Nakba Day. They take the kids to villages around Jerusalem that were demolished during the war in 1948. And it was, you know, this small bubble, but that was the idea. Until this point when, of course, if you follow the news, so the bilingual school in Jerusalem, unfortunately, was torched. It was very sad. One of the saddest moments here in Illinois to see the classes of my kids just after being burned by extreme Israelis back then. And thus the graffiti's death for Arabs were there always, like in the new TV show that I wrote. We don't even mention that. He takes his kid to the school, and it's always like the security guy is just erasing death for Arabs or Arabs to hell or things like that from the walls of the street. And of course they knew how to read. The problem is with identity and creating this thing was I think that realizing that I cannot really lie to my kids. I cannot even tell my kids the basics of democracy, that one day they can be equal in the state of Israel. So what I'm doing here, just confusing them, and really, can I really fight segregation and rules in Israel? So during the Gaza War, I felt like a really huge failure back there. So yes, it is very sad, and I think it's the kids. Not that I'm sure what's going to happen to their identity and their language, and are they going to be accepted like Americans after a few years? But so I don't know. I don't know what I'm doing to my kids. Sometimes it feels like, you know, the best thing I was supposed to do is just to follow what the Israelis want from Arabs inside Israel to do, which means finish your classes, finish your study, and go live in your village, because that's the reality and that's the what happens there. So yes, kids and identity. It's a scary thing, I guess.
Okay, I'm going to use my prerogative here to ask the first question. As we could all see, these two guys are completely devoid of any sense of humor. And but seriously,
is this the big brother or just one?
But seriously, I think that in a sense, your writing is filled with humor and sometimes satire, sometimes could be a bit sarcastic maybe, but in a sense I think that in many ways the sense of humor that you use may be a way to mitigate some of the seriousness that obviously is coming more and more into the discussion. Can you relate a little bit to the way that you use humor in a way to deal with a very, very serious situation, which in many ways, otherwise, if you don't laugh at it, you may have to cry.
Yes, I think I don't feel like I can always use humor. Not when the situation is sad. I think that my last columns were really, really very tragic and very sad, and there was nothing to do with humor. For many years, yes, I believed in the power of humor, and I always would say, like, I don't know who said that, but, you know, probably, yeah, I don't know. That if you want to tell people the truth, it's better, you better make them laugh, otherwise they can kill you. So that was the way for me to use humor at the beginning. I realized that I need to humanize the Arab characters. Of course, in the TV show, it's a comedy. In order to bring the story of Arabs in primetime commercial TV to the mainstream Israeli living room. So yes. And it's not this kind of humor that they call really, just don't shoot me, I can tell you a joke. It's because it's also a tool that I thought can make people listen. I will tell you a joke, you can laugh at me, and even it's going to be a joke on me. Yes, I'm going to be using all the stereotypes that you know about Arabs that will make you laugh, and then I'm going to tell you another story, and maybe we can laugh equally, and then I'm going to tell you another story, hopefully that will make you cry and even think. So yes, for many, many years, of course, I believed in the power of humor also to address political sensitive political issues in my writings in the newspaper, and mainly for Arab labor and the TV. But again, in order to use humor, yeah, it's true. You can be really very sad. But I think that you need some kind of hope, at least. I felt like that. And something should be stable. I realized that I cannot really be funny when I don't feel like my life is stable enough. Like if there's a war going on and I cannot really use humor. So I have to be not that scared in order to use humor. Do you understand what I mean?
Yeah. I wish there were less wars so we could see more humor from you. I think that, as Syed say, he does a very clever job, and maybe this is the answer to the question that people ask: how could an Arab-speaking TV series written by an Arab, played mostly by Arabs, become such a big hit in Israeli commercial mainstream TV? And really, you have to understand, Channel 2, it's like they don't care about social issues, about politics. They care about money and about viewers. And
they are my bosses, so I can assure you that they do care about values and culture.
And I think it's exactly that. It's inviting the viewers, and patting them on the head a bit, and telling them a joke, and making them smile, and making them laugh, and then suddenly turning the mirror and showing them, oh, wait a minute. And I think it's done very cleverly, in a way that did not alienate the mainstream TV audience or Israelis in general, but still managed to kind of send little arrows of messages to people. Now, did it change anything? That's another question.
I think that the peace agreement would never have been signed without Arab labor.
Which peace agreement?
No, but that was the frustrating thing. It's after so many years of working and to realize that it takes me 1 year usually to write a season of Arab labor. And, you know, so we believed like we can change things. Because you see the things on the set also, the Arab actors with the Jewish actors. Shai Kapon, the director, the wonderful director that we worked so close. Not in the movie. In the movie, I had no connection with the director. I just wrote the script and they did whatever they want. But in the TV, we worked so close together, and yes, we did that, of course, because I wanted to change reality a little bit. So it was frustrating to see that 5 minutes in the 8 o'clock news is enough to ruin 4 years of hard work on writing. Just the writing takes me 1 year for a season, and then of course, shooting and rehearsing and editing, it takes something like 2 years to prepare a TV show. in Israel. And that was very painful. That's the reason also the last summer was traumatic. It's not that it happened out of nowhere. Yes, of course, since 2000 the situation is getting worse, and unfortunately, yeah, it looks like the government is choose to address the Arabs in a very different, in a very radical, extreme way. And but I believed in people. So yes, did it change? It, of course. Since I started working, the situation is just getting worse. So I'm taking no responsibility on the politics of Israel.
Questions? There's a question in the front here. Rabbi Azriel.
It's not really a question. It's reading. You're right about the last few columns. They have been very depressing and very, very hard to read. Especially reading the comments of Israeli readers of Haaretz. They are totally surprised. They are like in shock, some of them, from discovering suddenly a different person. And I'm just curious about why. I mean, the humor is a way of covering up, really, sometimes deep things that you wanted to write and say. And maybe you fooled some of the Israelis, the readers of Haaretz, week after week when you finish your columns, in thinking, wow, this is an Arab that is modern and he's almost writing like a Jew. And suddenly they are in shock now. So I have been reading some of those remarks on your articles, and it's getting me depressed about not really knowing your identity, even now, after all those years.
You mean the readers or me? Yes, but talkbacks, I think I stopped reading them for more than 2 years now. And because they can be really very nasty and scary, so I just I listened to the advice of my editor in Haaretz. Just do yourself a favor and don't read talkbacks. And to be honest, I don't know why Haaretz published talkbacks. And sometimes I just wanted to ask them at the beginning just to stop that, because you know, go to Gaza would be the most popular comic there, and. But I just don't read that. I just don't read it. And last week, actually, it was not my column on Friday. It was Rogel Alper wrote about the new TV show, and my wife read one of the comments there, written by Rona, like he says, okay, as you said, I love Sayed Kashua, and I'm really very sad that he's in the States, and actually I want him to come back to Israel and directly to my bed, something like that. So my wife read that and said, did you write yourself a comment? Said no. So who is this Rona? I have no idea who is this Rona. It's crazy.
You have no idea. Huh?
No. Never with Rona. But
a question.
But it's not that they were shocked. It was always. It was. But actually, the columns. Yes, sometimes they are funny and sometimes they are sad. And there's a collection of the columns that will be released in February, I think, here in by Grove Atlantic, my American publisher. And one of the reviews written in Israel. And he really wrote that he read the collection of the columns that were published in Israel, and then he realized that I was fooling him actually the whole time, thinking that he's this some kind of comedy shtetl style, and actually he realized that it's such a sad column, and that it was already there since the beginning, that it will end up, that this column will end up with someone who will never manage to be accepted as a citizen, whatever he chooses to do in his life, like writing in Hebrew and raising his kids as bilingual and living in Western, and so yes, I think that smart readers would see the sadness behind the humor that I used. It's a little bit just like the movie, unfortunately. Also, it's the fact that in order, one of the levels is in the end that Iyad realized that he needs a Jewish mother in order to be part of the society. That's the only rule there. It's not the language that you speak. It's not. It's not the culture that you're doing. It's not the, you know, being a good citizen or whatever. It's the question is, are you Jewish or not? Do you have a Jewish mother or not? And that's the reason that he buries his identity in the end of the movie. So that's the problem. And I look at my kids, and they don't have a Jewish mother. I can always blame it on my wife, of course, their problems in life. Listen, I did my best. It's not my problem. It's just your mother. She's not Jewish. That's the reason that you're suffering. Yes, I think. If she was a Rona.
Okay, there's a question in the back. You have the...
Yes, hello, gentlemen. I was wondering, drawing specifically from the film, do you think that with the increased security barriers in Israel and Palestine and with the advances in identification technology, etc., do you think the ability of somebody like Iyad to assume somebody like Yonatan's identity so easily and in such confidence could happen in 2015? I know, you know, 1990 seems to be a world away in terms of technology and security. Obviously, it's much more conflict-ridden over there. Can such a story take place in 2015? And by extension, I suppose, can such a love story between an Arab and an Israeli take place in 2015 as it did 25 years ago?
It's a fiction. I don't know. I'm sure that also faking identity back in the 90s wouldn't be such an easy process. So it never happened. Jerusalem of today. The situation of Jerusalem was always bad, but of course now it's in the worst condition, and it's amazing for me that Israelis are surprised, really, because I've been living in Jerusalem, and sometimes it's like in the Israeli media and Channel 2, for example, they why is that happening? You know, teenagers stabbing Israelis in the streets of Jerusalem. Why? That they are shocked. Really? Just take a car and go to East Jerusalem to understand why is that happening. Because it was happening already. People were killing each other in those neighborhoods earlier. It's only when it comes to becoming victims, Israelis to be victims or being stabbed in the streets. So then we ask, why does that happen? Is it the Hamas behind them? Is it Al-Aqsa Mosque? Seriously, just take a car and see how miserable life there. Just look at the results of the education system in East Jerusalem and the poverty. 75% of the people of East Jerusalem are under the poverty line, and to see how much it's crowded and see how much it's filled with settlements in the deep heart of Arab neighborhoods there. So that's the tragedy, that people can act like they are blind and they are shocked that it happens. How come their life should be better in East Jerusalem because they have health insurance? Seriously, it's health insurance, and there is no way to compare between East Jerusalem and West Jerusalem, and life. It's so sad that there's a young generation that all we left them is depression and revenge. So it's much more divided now than even a year ago when we left. But it's really very clear. Yes, you see Arabs, of course, in the streets of Jerusalem, but they are the ones to clean the streets of Jerusalem and to work in the kitchens and restaurants of West Jerusalem. I used to study in Jerusalem, you know, when I used to go to high school in Jerusalem, and then during the university in the 90s, there used to be two theaters in East Jerusalem, and there used to be cinemas. Everything was shut down. There is not even one political institution. The Orient House, it was, of course, a political institution, but also a library and a social club, was closed by the Israeli forces. They did all their best to close all the magazines, all the newspapers, all the theaters, disconnecting the East Jerusalem from the rest of the West Bank. People from Ramallah cannot enter East Jerusalem. It's one of the saddest places. After 8, there is nothing to do. It's just so dark, and the crime is growing so huge there. My wife was a psychotherapist and a social worker, and she used to work there. And just open one door in East Jerusalem, in the old city, to realize how many tragic stories you'll find there. So that's East Jerusalem. And sometimes it feels sorry about that. If you make a survey maybe in East Jerusalem, people would vote for Israel. That most of them, that's the reason it's like young kids who are doing that. People would say that they would like to stay as residents. They are not citizens, residents of Jerusalem, because they lost the ability to dream of a better future, because they really became slaves that cannot afford losing the master more than the master can. He doesn't need him, but they are so attached to him, you know. He's the one that's feeding him, and that's very sad. About love stories, I don't know. I think that it happens all the time. Until now, in Jerusalem.
But I think that going on from this impossible gap, this huge gap, and back to your question about how realistic it is today or 20 years ago, I think that this is again one of the clever themes of this film, which is, yes, it is impossible. And by showing us that the only way that an Arab kid could reach a happy end is by this, you know, almost impossible to believe way of getting a Jewish mother, I think that just shows us even stronger the how this gap is impossible to bridge. So I would say no, it's not realistic, but that's more or less the point, or that's at least a reading that I could give it.
By the way, it's not like the love stories between Arabs are, you know, it's very uncommon and it's very rare, but I think that, you know, it I hope it happens. I don't know.
Does. Thank you for bringing your film. I appreciated that very much. I was very struck by the scene in the classroom early on in the film when, excuse me, when the kids are asked what their fathers do, yes. And Ayed insists that his father is a terrorist,
yes.
Instead of a fruit picker.
Yes.
And then I think I'm probably paraphrasing this poorly, but I think the father, in response to the child afterwards, says that the word terrorist was either made up by the Jews, that was the definition. What, can you help me with that? What was the intention of the emphasis on that word?
Oh, first of all, he didn't understand the word in Hebrew. He just didn't want the principal to, you know, he didn't want to feel that his father is a fruit picker, it's called. So he read in the newspaper, the Jews, oh, your father is a terrorist, mechabel. So he didn't know what that means, but it sounds like a better occupation, mutar, a better job than picking fruit. That was the reason. That he said, my father is a mechabel. It's just like, I'm not going to admit that my father works in picking fruit. That was the idea of behind that scene. In reality, and I think that I use the same newspaper that I found, my father was arrested when he was a student in the Hebrew University back in 69. That is a story in the novel also. But he was never charged. He was politically active. He was in Matzpein. It's a very left-wing, a radical Trotskyist movement back then.
And joint Jewish and Arab.
Yes, yes, yes. But he was arrested for 2.5 years because there is something called in Israel, as you know, Ma'atzar Minhali, administrative detention. So it means that you don't really have to charge the person. It's enough that the Shabakh decides that he's a threat or his ideas or his activity are a threat in order to put him in jail for 6 months and then to renew it for another 6 months. He spent 2.5 years in jail. And of course, he never talked about that, actually, my father. But it's very clear that it was one of the tragic, sad periods of his life. So that was based also in a true story.
Yeah. Okay, so now I am totally confused because originally I was going to ask you if this movie was autobiographical, and then you said that it was fiction. Now you're saying it's part autobiographical.
Yes.
So
you cannot really trust an Arab. No, I'm just kidding. No, to be honest, yes, parts of the. I grew up in Tira and I was sent to a Jewish boarding school. That's reality. And my father spent time in jail
And you met Rona and had this.
Yeah. Yes.
This story.
Yes. And.
But the actual story, I think, with paralyzed guy and the actual borrowed identity, yes. That's the fiction.
Yes. So actually all of my writing is I really enjoy very much confusing also the readers sometimes. As mentioned here, even the novel itself, Dancing Arabs, you know, probably if you ask me any every question about the book, I would say, yes, that happened. But it's not autobiographical in that sense that I'm not trying to tell the truth and only the truth about that. I think also, although my columns can be really, really very personal, I write about my experience and about my family, but of course it's my life usually is too boring to tell, so I'm basing that on my life, but I will never lie in my columns or in my writings about important things. Yes, I can write fictional dialogue between me and my wife, but I will never lie in such things like, you know, my grandfather was shot in 48 or my grandmother lost her land, something like that. Like, I very much hope that the reader of my columns, the readers know, they know very well when it's reality and when it's fiction, when it looks more like short stories. But in the movie, yes, so part of it, actually, it's I mixed stories from two novels, and so the first part is so it's not a autobiographical movie again, but it's based parts of it based on my own private experience. Yes.
First, I have an observation and then a short question. For me, the interesting part of the movie is not the conflict between Arabs and Jews. That seems secondary. That the deeper meaning is the nature of identity. Yes. And my question is, would this film have worked in the opposite direction, where you have a young Jewish man trying to pass as an Arab?
Well, Benjamin Netanyahu is doing his best to look like Arab leaders in the middle. No, I'm just kidding.
The question is, why would he?
Exactly. I mean, yesterday I was asked in Seattle, like, would a Jewish man, how can he live in an Arab village? I said, I'm going to beat him for his own sake. What, you have nothing to look for in an Arab village. If a Jewish man wants to... to fake, if a Jewish man wants to become a Muslim, it's the easiest thing in the world, you know, and he doesn't need to join Daesh. Not at all. He just needs to say a few words and that's it. I really don't recommend him to do that, though, at all. But faking identity, like, if you want to become Muslim or Christian, it's really very easy. It's not, you don't need to bring a, you don't have to bring a Muslim or an Arab mother in order to become or maybe a little bit to learn the language. But faking identity in that sense, to hide it and to be part of it, yes, I think many Mossad people are doing that every day now, I think. And they're doing that very good. No, actually, 60% of the population of Israel, all they need to do in order to be Arabs is to admit that they are Arabs, actually, with Jewish religion. But so, yes.
Yeah, I mean, you have to really understand it's not really, it's not even at all. So it's like asking if My Fair Lady, if Higgins could try to become Eliza. I mean,
do you call yourself a professor?
So it's so that's really the question. Why would he? But as you say, there are a few special units in the Israeli army doing that all the time. Yeah.
One of the works that I read about the Mistarevim, it's like Israeli soldiers who look like Arabs. And one of the crazy things that I read, it was the Mistarevim, this unit, that's the name of the unit who people, Israeli soldiers who assimilate and look like Arabs.
In order to get into the terrorist.
Yes. So it was even before the establishment of the state in 1948, they had the Mistarevim. And they sent them to work in Syria and Lebanon and different places. And they were Arabs. They were Iraqis and Egyptians. And they, yeah, and then in the orders, like, you have to eat like an Arab, sleep like an Arab, something like that. But actually, they came from Arab countries back then. So that was, it's something that you should read. It's sad and funny.
Write a novel. You should write about it.
Hi, my name is Dr. Salhany. I'm a retired professor at the University of Nebraska Medical Center. And I wanted to point out an interesting possibility for you to consider or speak on, and that is cultural diffusion, food, for example, and scientific exchange. I was involved through a series of events with a woman from Tel Aviv in our laboratory here in Omaha. And it, you know, it worked really well. We worked together to get a grant from the National Science Foundation, which allows exchange between American laboratories and Israeli laboratories. And we got it, which was really exciting because I thought, this is now I'm finally going to get to Israel in the Middle East. I'm, by the way, Christian Arab extraction. My dad was born in Damascus, and my mother's family are from Nazareth. Okay, well, it was all set up and ready to go, except that Nerit's husband, who is a physician in Israel, couldn't find a job, and he got a job at Harvard. And I arranged for Nerit to go up there and work. So, you know, it's interesting that that possibility existed, and I'm hoping that that continues to be the case. I wondered if you had any insight into that.
I can just add one thing to that. Universities on the West Bank and universities in Israel do not cooperate. They're not, faculty members are not, you know, allowed actually to do faculty exchange. So on an academic level, that's not a possibility.
On the other hand, there are all kinds of corporations, and we should point it out on many levels: theater, culture, business. It's very small, and it's struggling, and it's drowning under the waves of hatred and racism that we have in Israel. But yeah, I mean, it does happen.
It's different. Actually, the major, which I'm not sure how clever that is, from the Palestinian side, is the military collaboration. It's the security one, which is a huge problem. But I think that after the Oslo Agreement, the collapse of the Oslo Agreement, and after 2000, it's different. I'm a Palestinian citizen of Israel. So I'm not really. There are some rules of the boycott that I should follow, but I don't do that, unfortunately. But if you are a Palestinian in West Bank and Gaza, most of the art and theater and academy and writers do not meet, and sometimes they even force themselves. I remember days that Israeli writers met with Palestinian writers, of course, but it no longer happens. It's much easier for the Israelis to say why you don't want to meet, because you are the man with the power and you are the majority. But of course, I very much realize and understand cultural movements in Palestine saying they are not saying we don't want to meet with Jews and Israelis, not at all. They're saying until the occupation is not ended, until we cannot meet as equals, so there is no. There is no sense to make these meetings and to fake like something is happening and to be used some kind of, you know, to be a fig leaf. And it's something that it always, you have always to be aware. For me also, as an Arab Palestinian citizen of Israel, I have always to be aware when I'm being used you know, to choose the right platforms in order to address my talk. So it's a very sensitive issue, and there is no cultural collaboration right now.
Right now on stage.
Yes.
Yeah, I would not sit with an Arab on stage.
Yes. No. You know. me neither, by the way. But.
Oh, we're in America. Okay.
I want to thank you very much for coming. Have a nice evening.
That was a pleasure. Really, thank you for speaking.
You've been listening to a program from Film Streams, Omaha's nonprofit cinema on Noon Forum. On today's program, we've heard a panel discussion which followed a special screening of the 2014 film A Borrowed Identity, directed by Eran Riklis. This program, presented in collaboration with the Schwab Center for Israel and Jewish Studies at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, October 27, 2015, for broadcast at this time. The members of the panel were the screenwriter of the film, Syed Kashua, and Asaf Gavron, visiting Israeli professor at the University of Nebraska at Omaha's Schwab Center. The moderator was Curtis Hutt, professor of Judaic Studies, and special programs coordinator for the Schwab Center at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. Special thanks to Rachel Jacobson, Patrick Kinney, Brooke Masick, Caitlin Lavelle Gustafson, and Jim Foyt of Film Streams, and Casey Davis, staff assistant with the Schwab Center for Israel and Jewish Studies, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 500 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.